Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Beth Emmanuel is committed to proclaiming the vital gospel message of the coming kingdom of heaven. If you share our passion for this message, please support this teaching ministry and messianic community with your prayers and financial contributions. To learn how, click the support button at BethEmmanuel.org.
Tonight is Back to the Future night. The teaching Back to the Future because we're going to wrestle with an important question about the future in the book of Revelation, about the future in the past, and we're going to learn some different interpretive schemes that people use to interpret the book of Revelation. We're going to try to answer this question. Is the book of Revelation a book about things that happened in the past, things that were to happen in the future of the past, or things that are to happen in our future? So that's what we're learning about. Another reason is that this is Back to the Future night is that this is October 21st, 2015, which is today. That is today, the date on which Marty McFly time-traveled 30 years into the future in the 80s movie Back to the Future Part 2, which was in itself a sequel to the original 1985 Back to the Future, in which McFly time-traveled 30 years into the past, from 1985 back to 1955. As such, Back to the Future, the Back to the Future 2 movie made predictions about what life would be like 30 years in the future, and in a way, that's sort of like the book of Revelation, I guess. Predicts the future. And now, here we are, in the future. We can also do the same with the book of Revelation and ask, how well did it depict the future, you know? And the important thing to remember about this is the point of reference. In his time travels, Marty McFly travels from October 26, 1985, according to this. And so he goes 30 years into the past, and then he returns, and then in the sequel, 30 years into the future, to October 21st, 2015, our present day. And after this, after tonight, our past. Yeah, that's how it works. The present becomes the past. My point is, to understand the movies, you have to understand the point of origin as the mid-1980s. You have to understand that what was already, you know, there are things that were already in the past in 1985, but there were things that were in the future in 1985, which are now in our past. Make sense? Yeah. I know. That's why we spent last week learning about the date of composition of the book of Revelation, the mid-90s, when the book of Revelation was written. And so this way we would have a point of reference to understand the future depicted in the book and the past as depicted in the book. And we learned, therefore, write these things, write the things which you have seen, and the things which are, and the things which will take place after these things. And what you have seen refers to what John just saw. I also take it to refer to the past as revealed by the one who was the past, who is the present, and who will be the God of the future. If we're using Revelation to predict the future, it's not going to work very well. Apocalypse is designed to reveal things that are at work behind the scenes. So it's inappropriate, in a sense, to even try to use the book of Revelation as if it was a straight-up prediction of the future, the way that Back to the Future was supposed to depict October 21st, 2015. That's not how Apocalypse is supposed to work. It's not like a crystal ball. It's a revelation of spiritual forces and heavenly places that lie behind the physical world of cause and effect. Nevertheless, if you've studied it before, you've heard Revelation taught before, you know that many people misuse the book of Revelation to try and to interpret current events, predict the near future, and even determine the return date of the Messiah on these grounds, if my calculations are correct. I don't mean to suggest to you that we cannot learn about the end times from the book of Revelation. After all, the book of Revelation is all about eschatology. Eschatology is a big word. Eschatology means the study of last things. So, you know, the thing about eschatology, it's funny to me. People say, you know, I don't teach eschatology. I really don't teach anything but eschatology. I think, if you're talking about the gospel, you're talking about the kingdom, that's all eschatology. But eschatology is a really divisive field. It's a classic thing. When I grew up in the church, people would fight over eschatology. I mean, they would dig in and fight over eschatology. But they were fighting over the smallest details of an eschatological scheme, such as, you know, what I'm talking about with the rapture people and the pre-trib and the post-trib and the mid-trib. And if you're not familiar with that kind of language, you're lucky. But as a rule, apocalypse does not work with any kind of level of precision like this. And neither does any other biblical prophecy that I'm aware of. Instead, in the Bible, we see that a biblical prophecy often has more than one fulfillment. And a biblical prophecy can refer to more than one circumstance on a literal level. But then on another level, it might refer to something more. For example, when we were studying the virgin conception last year, we found prophecies that applied to King Hezekiah. Remember, we were looking at prophecies that applied to King Hezekiah, and we found that they also applied to King Messiah. They predicted things about the Messiah. So, you know, it'd be pretty difficult if you were trying to see that from the other side of things. Moreover, apocalypse and biblical prophecy create general categories of symbolic agents which Jewish tradition assigns and reassigns. For example, I think of how many times I've seen in different rabbinic sources where this conflict or that conflict is identified as the war of Gog and Magog. The war of Gog and Magog really gets around. It's just like, I suppose, how many times you might have heard someone make a reference to the beginning of the Battle of Armageddon or something like that. But so understanding how apocalypse works and biblical prophecy in general might have more than one potential outcome, even more than just one fulfillment. If we get that, then we shouldn't expect to find a clear, literal picture of the future or the end times in the book of Revelation. But that's how, you know, that's a lot of times that's how people read it, as if it was a newspaper from the future, you know, that somebody brought back with a newspaper from the future. It's detailing the day-to-day tribulations during the tribulation, you know, it'd be the Tribulation Tribune or something like that. You know, I picture the poor weatherman, you know, who has to deal with that. So it's like, watch for mixed precipitation today. We'll be having hail and fire. Changing over to blood in the later afternoon. it doesn't work like that. That's not how biblical prophecy works. Certainly not how the apocalypse is, with their heightened imagery and symbolism, supposed to work. Maimonides warns us, in fact, from making any sort of dogmatic statements about the sequence of events in the end times. He says, "No man knows how all these matters and their likes will unfold until they do. For they are obscure in the writings of the prophets. Neither do the sages have a firm tradition about these things. They depend upon debatable interpretations of the biblical verses. Therefore, there is a disagreement among the sages regarding these matters. But no man knows how all these matters and their likes will unfold until they do." The specific details are not essential for faith. One should not obsess over legends and interpretations derived from Midrash that deal with these and similar matters, nor should one deem them to be essentials. For they bring one neither to the fear of God, nor to the love of God. That's Maimonides on end times prophecy stuff. This statement that he makes, I really like this statement. The specific details are not essential for faith. The specific details of eschatology are not essential. I agree. No man knows how these things will unfold. So how could the specific details be essential if nobody knows how they'll unfold? They remain obscure in biblical prophecy. But at the same time, There are big picture pieces of eschatology which are essential. No one knows how things will unfold until they do unfold, but they're certainly going to unfold. So here's a second rule that goes with that. General eschatology is essential. And I'm going to show you what I mean by that as we move forward tonight. But it's not essential to salvation. When I say it is essential, it's not essential to salvation or anything like that. That's the wrong box. But essential to correctly interpreting the scriptures, essential to the faith, essential to understanding and living the faith. If so, then, having the general eschatology down is going to be absolutely essential for understanding a book of eschatology, a book of Jewish eschatology, like the book of Revelation. To the original gospel, the message of our master, the message Yeshua was teaching, the good news. He was, you know, and it was about the future. He was teaching about the kingdom of heaven. He was saying, repent, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. That was the good news, the message of the gospel. The kingdom of heaven is the messianic era. And what is the messianic era but a golden age? The golden age when all the prophecies fulfilled the rabbinic and Jewish ideas of the literal kingdom of heaven on this physical earth, when King Messiah is going to reign from Jerusalem, seated on David's throne, of course, and all these biblical prophecies about the glorious redemption of the Jewish people are going to come true. Also called the millennium. Why is it called the millennium? Well, because it's supposed to last at least 1,000 years. And if you believe in a millennium, if you believe in this idea of a coming golden age, that's going to last 1,000 years or so, then you are a millennialist. Well, not a millennial, but a millennialist or Achilleist, which is the same thing, means the same thing. Millennialism is the belief in a coming literal kingdom that will last 1,000 years, okay? So, are you one? Something else that you might not have known you are is Achilleist, but we also think that you should refer to yourself as a premillennialist. Because a premillennialist is somebody who believes that the Messiah will come before this millennium and not after the millennium. I don't know why. Whoever thought otherwise? But in any case, it is the belief in a literal kingdom of heaven on this physical earth that will last 1,000 years. Got it? It used to be a basic concept of the gospel message. It used to be a really fundamental concept of the kingdom of heaven is at hand, and the message, the kingdom of heaven is at hand, doesn't make much sense without it. It's also closely related, by the way, this is just a by the way, it's also closely related to Sabbatarianism, because the seventh day foreshadows the seventh millennium in this scheme of thought. So it's like, well, the 6 days of the work week or the 6 days of the week represent 6,000 years of human history unfolding, and then the seventh day, the Sabbath, represents the millennium. It's closely associated with Sabbatarianism, at least historically. Most millennialists were Sabbatarians. For example, got this guy. Found this guy, church writer Hippolytus. He's about a third century fellow, maybe. I think he's about a third century fellow. He says, 6,000 years must needs be accomplished in order that the Sabbath may come, the rest, the holy day on which God rested from all his works. For the Sabbath is the type and emblem of the future kingdom of the saints, when they shall reign with Christ, when he comes from heaven, as John says in his Apocalypse. For a day with the Lord is as 1,000 years, it says in the Psalms. Since then, in 6 days, God made all things. It follows that 6,000 years must be fulfilled. This is Hippolytus and how he understood it. But Hippolytus, I'm sorry to tell you, was in the minority. By the third century, most Christians were no longer millennialist. We're no longer believing in a millennium. At least not in a literal level. And those that were, those who did believe in a literal messianic kingdom from Jerusalem, were pejoratively dismissed as Jewish and carnal and fleshly and holding on to Jewish ideas. How did this happen? How did we get to this point so quickly? When the whole message was the kingdom of heaven is near, the whole message was about this future kingdom of heaven, how did we get to a point where all the followers of the person proclaiming this message no longer believed the essential matter of the message? All right, I'll tell you. You are so lucky that I'm here to tell you. The factors eroding millennialism. Here are the factors eroding millennialism. In the second century, Gnosticism. Gnosticism had a heavy influence on the second century church, on second century Christianity, and Gnosticism taught that physical matter is evil. Therefore, Gnosticism was not looking for a physical, literal kingdom that would be in the physical world. It didn't make sense from a Gnostic worldview. How could that be the goal? That's still here in this physical world. Gnosticism taught that the God of the Jews was corrupt and had been replaced by the God of the New Testament. And so it didn't make sense, the idea of a restored Israel. It didn't make sense in Gnosticism. So Gnosticism taught that biblical prophecy about the nation of Israel was untrue, and that salvation, according to Gnosticism, salvation was purely a spiritual release of the soul to go to heaven. So you go to heaven after you die. That's it. No physical resurrection, no physical kingdom on earth. And Gnosticism, although it was dismissed as heretical, it left a big influence on the church. Second thing, separation from Judaism. The church separated from Judaism, as we know, at the end of the first century, near the end of the first century. And separation from Judaism meant losing Jewish interpretation of the scriptures, losing the Sabbath, losing the concept of the Jewish people as the people of God and the heirs of the prophets and the prophetic promises. And so therefore, because of that, the church had no interest in a reestablished Israel, and therefore no interest in the prophecies about a literal kingdom. So factors one and two then combined to force an allegorical reinterpretation of biblical prophecy, because what are you going to do with this big, thick Bible now? So it forces a reinterpretation of biblical prophecy, turning the prophecies upside down, turning the prophecies about the redemption and the reestablishment of Israel into predictions about the church, which replaced Israel. And here's replacement theology coming in. So to make this work, the prophecies could not be taken literally on their face value. Neither could the idea of the kingdom on earth be taken literally. And this, by the way, explains why the church was so slow to receive the book of Revelation, reluctant to canonize the book of Revelation along with the rest of the New Testament texts. And in fact, by the First Council of Constantinople, belief in the millennium was repudiated as heresy. So, if that's where you're at by the First Council of Constantinople, what do you do with a problem like Revelation? What are you going to do with this book? You could do like the 3rd century Christian writer Gaius of Rome did and simply declare Revelation to be a forgery. Here's a quote. Through revelation supposedly penned by a great apostle, the book of Revelation offers us false tales of wonders allegedly shown to him by angels. After the resurrection, he says, the kingdom of Christ will be on earth, and humanity living at Jerusalem will again be enslaved to lusts and pleasures, in other words, the physical body. The author of Revelation is the enemy of the scriptures of God, and in his anxiety to deceive, claims that marriage festivities will last 1,000 years. All right, so this is a church writer, Gaius of Rome. Likewise, there's this guy, Dionysius of Alexandria. While refuting some Jewish heresies in the church, he pointed out that most people believe the book of Revelation is a forgery, or many people believe it's a forgery. So he says, the author of the book of Revelation wished to add an authoritative note to his creation. So he prefixed the name of John to the book of Revelation. And he taught that Christ's kingdom would be on earth. And being in love with his own body and thoroughly sensual, he dreamed up a paradise of his own lust, full of endless gluttony and eating and drinking and marrying. That is the messianic banquet we're describing here. Or, in the euphemisms for all these things, festivals, sacrifices, and sacrifice of animals. That is the biblical calendar and the millennial age temple that we're describing here. However, I have to give Dionysius his due. He says he himself accepts the book. He said, I myself would never dare reject the book. I take the view that the interpretation of the various sections is a mystery, too wonderful for comprehension. That is, not intended literally. I do not understand it. I suspect a deeper meaning is concealed in the words. I am not prepared, however, to admit that the author was John. Okay, so this is Dionysius. And these guys are typical, these early church writers are typical of how to deal with revelation. So the early church had three ways to deal with revelation. There's acceptance, and acceptance meant millennialism. There's rejection, like we just saw, and that's amillennialism, which is where most of the church was at. But there's also the possibility of allegorical reinterpretation, like Dionysius went for there so that he could, you know, have his book of Revelation and his amillennialism too. And that's how the church handled it. How do we, you know, that was how the early church dealt with this. So how do we interpret the book today when it's firmly a part of the New Testament canon and rejection is no longer on the table? You can't it's canonized at this point. So the answer is there are four roads of interpretation. The futurist, the preterist, the historist, and the idealist. Which one do you think you are? A futurist, a preterist, a historist, or an idealist? I found this summary of these four roads online from Ligonier Ministries. All right, a futurist. We'll start with a futurist. A futurist is a millennialist. And the main thing with the futurist position is it believes that the book of Revelation, specifically chapters 4 through 22, which is after we get through the epistles to the seven churches, describes the future, which sounds good. But the future that's being described is our future. In other words, none of this has been fulfilled yet. All right, so this is like taking the Back to the Future movie and not realizing that you're watching a movie from 1985, but thinking rather that you're watching a movie that came out and was just made and is set in 2015. There's some advantages to a futurist position. Like I pointed out, you can be a millennialist. It keeps our eyes looking for the redemption, looking for the coming of the Messiah. And I like that it takes these prophecies literally and deals with them with weight. But the disadvantage is that if you take a futurist interpretation, the book of Revelation, therefore, had absolutely no relevance for John or for the communities that he sent them to. It was a pointless exercise. It had nothing to do with the situation in 95 Common Era. It's all about us. It's all about our future. All right, so that's futurist approach. The preterist approach. Preterist, that's a Latin root in that word, praetor. It refers to the past. So the preterist approach takes the opposite tack of futurism. The preterist approach describes events. It has the revelation describing these events that took place in the first century or in the early centuries of Christianity, depends on which kind of preterism you're reading. But everything then in the book of Revelation, except perhaps the final consummation at the very end with the New Jerusalem and so forth, already took place. Took place, most of it before 70 and the destruction of the temple, or in the lifetime of John. And so there's some advantages to this. Actually, I like this quite a bit. Intrigued by preterism. Revelation speaks of events that must soon take place, not events in a distant future, far removed from the circumstance of the early church. Preterism interprets Revelation as relevant to believers during Domitian's persecutions. It interprets it with relevance to the apostolic generation that saw the destruction of the temple in the beginning of the exile. The disadvantages to preterism is that then the book just becomes a historical curiosity and does not offer any insights into our future. And moreover, it's very difficult to force everything in the book of Revelation into the first century. It really just doesn't fit in the first century. And from a preterist point of view, the kingdom gets ignored. The kingdom message disappears from the preterist interpretation. All right, how about the historicist? According to the historicist, the book of Revelation charts history from the birth of the Messiah until the kingdom. This is an interesting approach. According to this approach, everything that happens in the story of Revelation is the story of history told in symbolism, the story of the centuries, the story of the church going through the centuries over the course of these 2,000 years. I like this. Chronological eras building up to the second coming, ultimately culminating in the second coming. So the historicist sees Revelation as telling the future from the vantage point of 95 Common Era. And some of that future is yet to unfold. Some advantages to this model is that this road of interpretation recognizes 95 Common Era, that point of view, as the point of reference. And it includes our future as well. So you get a little bit of both. But this approach tends to be very rigid, working with charts, trying to force history to match the book of Revelation and the various trumpets sounding through the generations and so forth. And it ignores the genre of apocalypse. All right, so one more, and then we'll be done. The idealist approach. What's the idealist approach? Well, from the perspective of the idealist, the book of Revelation depicts spiritual tropes, themes, and symbols which manifest through history in various forms until the final redemption. This is pretty good, too. I like this, too. It's not possible to tie things down to any one single interpretation according to this model. For example, Antichrist could take on many, many guises. There could be an Antichrist in every generation, according to this model. The disadvantage is that from the idealist point of view, there's really no end to what you can make Revelation mean at any point if you're just creative enough. Which of these four roads of interpretation? Futurist, preterist, historicist, idealist, which road? All of the above, I think, is good. Sort of a cop-out. All of the above acknowledges that there are elements of truth in all of these approaches that we've identified thus far. Preterism is correct because it insists that the visions of Revelation reflect events and circumstances that were taking place in the days of the apostles at the time of the writing of the book of Revelation. It's pertinent to the believers to whom it was addressed. But preterism isn't the whole story. There's more to it than that. There's more to it than just the first century, as we said. The futurist approach partially solves the problem by emphasizing that, there's more to come. There's more, but the problem with that approach is that it ignores that quite a bit has already happened, that quite a bit is already rooted in history. The historicist tries to impose this artificial structure that is derived from reading the book of Revelation on history and tries to jam history over the last 2,000 years into this sequential model, the sequential reading of the book of Revelation. The problem with the idealist is that it's just the interpretations become very, very slippery in your hands, in the hands of the idealist. Which one is it? All of them have something to offer. We can take something from all of these models. I know that sounds like a cop-out. Maybe it is a cop-out. But none of these are correct by themselves. So what we're going to have to do is we're just going to have to be very careful as we proceed. And we're going to look at things and say, could this be something that had its fulfillment in the past, in John's past, or in the contemporary world of the first century? Could this be something that has its fulfillment some point in history between the time of the book of the writing of the book of Revelation and our current day? Do we find that this corresponds to anything we know between then and now? Or could this be something that is yet to come, something that will be part of the eschaton, the end times, something that we're looking towards as part of the herald of the redemption? Or could this be something which is always with us in one form or another, in the struggle of light against darkness?
Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your soul.